a wonderful fact to reflect upon, that every human creature is constituted to be that profound secret and mystery to every other. We're in Book the First. We're looking at chapters 2, 3, and 4 of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. I'm Allison Pittman, and these are my margin notes. Everybody, welcome back, and picking up with this next section of Book the First. It's not going to be a detailed blow-by-blow of these four chapters, otherwise this would be an incredibly long episode of margin notes. I don't intend or anticipate to hold anybody's attention long enough for that, but it is going to focus on this introduction of the part of the London cast of characters, with London being one of the two cities of which this is a tale. So just a quick moment of confession. From the very first time I read this novel, I've been teaching English for 30 years, and probably the first 10 years of my teaching, I was working in resource reading classes, working with students on very basic reading skills. And then I was given a chance to teach pre-AP and AP English, and I just jumped on it because that's really what was in my heart to do. And the first book that I would be teaching that year was A Tale of Two Cities with my pre-AP sophomores. So I have just absolute clear memories of buying my copy of A Tale of Two Cities, thinking to myself, oh, I can't wait to lead students through all these great conversations and discussions of literature. And I read through the first chapter and I was just in love with all the symbolism and all the metaphors and the woodsman and the farmer and fate and death and all this stuff. And then I got to chapter 2 and I just stopped and what has happened? What is this about? And I was so disappointed in myself. I just didn't get it. I just didn't get what was happening. And I went to the woman who was co-teaching this class with me. Her name's Rebecca Robinson. She's a brilliant woman. And I said, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening. And I said, I need to just go to the Cliff's Notes and read the summary and figure it out. She said, no. You know, Cliff's Notes were just the bane of our existence. And she gave me just the best advice. She said, if you don't understand it, read it again. And if you don't understand it the second time, read it again. If you don't understand it the third time, just go on to the next chapter and see if the next chapter will pull you along into the story. And that is exactly how I had to read these next few chapters of this novel the first time I ever read it. I would get to the end of a chapter and just be clueless. I got to the end of chapter 2 and was like, what just happened? Who are these people? What is the message? Who is Jerry? What is going on? And I didn't know. But I think Dickens is like, I could imagine him just saying, that's okay. He'd probably say it with an accent, but I do a lousy British accent. But he'd say, read the next chapter. So if you read the next chapter, it kind of hooks you into the chapter before and brings you through. And so you might still be a little bit foggy, so read the next chapter. And the next chapter is going to have hooks back in 2 and 3 and bring it all forward. And so getting through these next 3 chapters, because, you know, sometimes it's easy to think of that first one as being like a prologue. We talked about that in the last episode, how most modern writers would have made that a prologue and start the action, start with chapter 1, the mail, here, instead of making this a second chapter. So I always think of these as the first chapters, even though already we should be thinking, oh, the previous chapter that tells us we're all fated to die and everybody's fate has already been sealed, so don't wait for happy endings, maybe. In fact, I'm looking at the last line of the previous chapters, where he says, thus did the year 1775 conduct their greatnesses and myriads of small creatures, the creatures of this chronicle among the rest, along the roads that lay before them. So the chronicles of these creatures, these characters from this story that we're going to meet over the course of these chapters. And we'll be meeting Mr. Jarvis Lorry, who is an employee of Tellson's Bank in London. We are going to meet Jerry Cruncher, who is just a fantastic character. I'm not going to give away all that Jerry is because it's sort of doled out to us bit by bit over the course of the story. If you honestly can't stand not to know who Jerry Cruncher is, or if you're not putting together all the pieces and the clues right now, Google him, like all the kids are doing these days. And we'll also meet Miss Lucy Manette, and the connection between Jerry and Lucy Manette we will figure out. So I'm going to first talk about Jerry Cruncher, who is just a delightful Dickensian creature. What I love about Jerry Cruncher is I really don't see who or what he could possibly be if we were to swoop up this entire story and set it modern day. He is such a creation of his time, the time period that he lived in. And he's just equal parts delightful and disgusting, which I think is hard to create, but there you go. So this first scene happens. I promise you, I'm not going to go through every single scene bit by bit by bit by bit. But like Dickens does in so many of his novels, think about that seaside graveyard in Great Expectations, or that cold, snowy street in A Christmas Carol. Here we're out on the roads in a mail coach. Okay, Jarvis Lorry is a passenger on this coach, and we have the two drivers. We have the driver and somebody who's up there as protection. It's with a shotgun. That's why we all yell shotgun as we're running out of the house, so we can have the seat next to the driver. And they're going through this night. Well, let me just read it. So there was a steaming mist in all the hollows, and it had roamed in its forlornness up the hill like an evil spirit, seeking rest and finding none. A clammy and intensely cold mist, it made its slow way through the air in ripples that visibly followed and overspread one another, as the waves of an unwholesome sea might do. It was dense enough to shut out everything from the light of the coach lamps, but these its own workings and a few yards of road, and the reek of the laboring horses steamed into it as if they had made it all. So it's this dark, cold, steamy, sloggy night. And Jerry Cruncher is introduced to that, riding up with a message for Jarvis Lorry. And so we learn, among many things, Jerry Cruncher is a messenger for Tellson's Bank. That he's well, he's a messenger. He's a messenger for, we'll find out, all kinds of, he's just a messenger. That's what he does. He runs messages around. And so immediately you know that he also then he spends a whole lot of time lurking around, just standing around in the street, seeing if anybody has a message that they have to have delivered. That was the only way to get a message from one place to another. And here he had the wherewithal to take this message and chase down and find this mail coach. The I'm sure there was a point where Tom and Joe, that's what Dickens named the driver and the guard, might have thought that he was a robber, okay, somebody coming to rob them. But he has this note for Jarvis Lorry, and Jarvis Lorry reads the note, and this is what it says. It says, "Wait at Dover for Mademoiselle." Wait at Dover for Mademoiselle. And so Jarvis gives his message back to Jerry Cruncher. He says, "Tell them that my answer is recalled to life." Now, if you have a copy of the book, and I would love it if you have a copy of the book and you're reading along and just enjoying this, but you would see that even though it's in dialogue, this is what Jarvis Lorry is saying. Recalled to life is in all capital letters. Okay, that's the sim. I don't know if he just thinks that Jerry's going to get it wrong, if that's to emphasize it. These days, I guess it's because we harp on it so much in social media, if somebody types or makes a posting or a tweet in all caps, we can maybe even imagine what it's like to speak in all caps. But here, Dickens has a character speaking in all caps, saying recalled to life. And Jerry's taken aback by that. He's like, "That's a strange message." He says, "That's a blazing strange answer," he says, at his horses. He has a very hoarse and raspy voice. And recall to life is a huge theme of the novel. So I can see why Dickens is putting all the brakes on everything and saying, "Hey, everybody, pay attention to this. Recalled to life." Because throughout the story, we're going to see this manifested in so many different of these little threads that will be woven together. They are all in some way a recalling to life. But this just takes Cruncher off his game. Okay, what does this mean? And stick with Jerry a little bit more as we go into the next chapter. We get a nice physical description of Jerry Cruncher after the messenger has gone away, and he so the messenger rode back at an easy trot, the messenger being Jerry Cruncher. He rode back in an easy trot, stopping pretty often at alehouses by the way to drink, but evincing a tendency to keep his own counsel and to keep his hat cocked over his eyes. He had eyes that assorted very well with that decoration, being of a surface black with no depth in the color or form, and much too near together, as if they were afraid of being found out in something singly if they were kept too far apart. So he has these dark, we call them now beady little eyes. They're dark. They've got no distinction maybe between their color and the pupils, and they're very close together. Okay, they're close to his little nose. They had a sinister expression under an old cocked hat like a three-cornered spittoon, and over a great muffler for the chin and throat, which descended nearly to the wearer's knee. When he stopped for a drink, he moved his muffler with his left hand only while he poured his liquor with his right. As soon as that was done, he muffled again. "No, Jerry, no," said the messenger. And he's just talking to himself. So he's sitting at a in an alehouse, his beady little eyes, and his hat pulled down over them, and his muffler up to his chin, talking to himself. "No, Jerry, no," said the messenger, harping on one of them as he rode. "It wouldn't do for you, Jerry, you honest tradesman. It wouldn't suit your line of business, recalled. But trust me, if I don't think he'd been a drinking." So he's obsessed, saying that recalled to life would be, he'd be in a bad way if recalled to life were true, if that meant anything. Do with that what you will. Dickens will make it clear in several chapters why that would affect him that way. His message perplexed his mind to a degree that he was fain several times to take off his hat and scratch his head. Except of the crown, which is raggedy bald, he had stiff black hair standing jaggedly all over it and growing downhill almost to his broad, blunt nose. It was so much like Smith's work, so much more like the top of a strongly spiked wall than a head of hair, that the best of players at Leapfrog might have declined him as the most dangerous man in the world to go over. Jerry Cruncher gives us a little bit of comic relief that we don't have throughout this novel. And that description is one of them. He's just filthy. And his hair is spiky and hard with dirt and grease and goodness knows what. But that idea that nobody would want to play leapfrog over him because it might endanger them, that is funny. He's contrasted with Jarvis Laurie. Jarvis Laurie, this man from Tellson's Bank. And in the other part of this chapter, when we go back in chapter 3 to Jarvis, and he's back in the mail coach, and the coach is just riding along, and he's dozing off, and he's dreaming. And as he has, it's talking about this state that he's in. The mail coach is lumbering, it jolted, it rattled, it bumped on its tedious way with its three fellow inscrutables inside, to whom likewise the shadows of night revealed themselves in the forms of their dozing eyes and wandering thoughts suggested. And Laurie's thoughts are about the bank, or about the bank, or about the bank. But then we have this one line that says he was on his way to dig someone out of a grave. And you just stop. You think, what? On his way to dig someone out of a grave? What does that mean? And then he, as he's in and out of a sleep-like state, he sees this face before him of the buried person, okay, the person that he's going to dig out of the grave. It says, the face of a man of 45 years, and they differed principally in the passions they expressed and the ghastliness of their own worn and wasted state. So it's this face that's kind of morphing in and out of what it looks like as he's envisioning it. And then he has this imagined conversation. Buried how long? The answer was always the same, almost 18 years. And you had abandoned all hope of being dug out? Long ago. And you know that you are recalled to life? They tell me so. I hope you care to live. I can't say. Shall I show her to you? Will you come and see her? And the answers to this question were various and contradictory. Sometimes the broken reply was, wait, it would kill me if I saw her too soon. And sometimes it was given in the tender rain of tears. And then it was, take me to her. Sometimes it was staring and bewildered. And then it was, I don't know her. I don't understand. And I did not understand this the first time I was reading the book. I had to go to the next chapter, see the meeting between Laurie and Lucy Manette, realize Laurie is the she that he's wondering if this vision is going to want to meet is Lucy Manette. There's something that's there, but he's been buried. He's been buried for 18 years. How does a guy who works at a bank unbury a body that's been buried for 18 years? Who are these people? And so just like we had in that quote at the beginning of the chapter, the beginning of the podcast that I read, a wonderful fact to reflect upon, that every human creature is constituted to be that profound secret and mystery to every other. So here we've already seen three creatures that are a mystery to each other. Jerry Cruncher, Jarvis Laurie, and we'll see Lucy Manette. And four, when we think about who is this man? Who is this man aged 45, who has been buried for 18 years and isn't sure if he wants to be recalled to life? Why would you not want to be recalled to life? So everything that seems so confusing, already it's working itself out. He's to stop at Dover, talk to Mademoiselle. His answer to whoever sent that message is recalled to life. And as we get to the end of that chapter, I love this. We started with, of course, the night, the dark, the mist, the damp, and the slogging, and all of that. When we get to the end of that chapter, Jarvis Lorry lowers the window, looks out at the rising sun. So, oh, here's our universally accepted symbol of hope, the rising sun. A ridge of plowed land with the plow upon it where it had been left the night when the horses were unyoked. Beyond, a quiet coppice wood in which many leaves of burning red and golden yellow still remained upon the trees. And though the earth was cold and wet, the sky was clear, the sun rose bright, placid, and beautiful. You know, contrast the horses that are plodding up the hill as they're carrying this coach with the horses that are plowing this land. A nice plowed field, that's hope. That's hope for a future. Something's going to be planted and something's going to grow from it. Okay, that's something that you can take as a promise. And it the earth was damp when the horses were slogging through it, but here it's damp with dew and it seems bright and placid and beautiful. And then the passenger, that's Lorry, says to himself, looking at the sun, 18 years, said the passenger, looking at the sun, gracious creator of day, to be buried alive for 18 years. So he's on his way to dig somebody out who'd been buried alive for 18 years. And if you're not hooked into this story now, you just have to be. You have to be, because there are so many questions about what this is. We're given a physical description of Jarvis Lorry. I love the way that Dickens introduces him from the inside out. And so we are with his thoughts and his dreams before we learn that he's this lovely kind of persnickety man who wears a nice, pristine white wig and lovely stockings and is very proud of his calves. They're his best feature. And he comes, as he has promised to do, to meet Mademoiselle. And here she comes in, Miss Manette. He meets her at this some kind of a public house or an inn, and she is just this beautiful girl. It says his eyes rested on a short, slight, pretty figure, a quantity of golden hair, a pair of blue eyes that met his own with an inquiring look, and a forehead with a singular capacity, remembering how young and smooth it was, of lifting and knitting itself into an expression that was not quite one of perplexity or wonder or alarm or merely of a bright fixed attention, though it included all the four expressions as his eyes rested on these things, a sudden vivid likeness passed before him of a child whom he had held in his arms on the passage across that very channel one cold time when the hail drifted heavily and the sea ran high. This is not a total stranger to him. He knows this girl. He knew her as a child. He carried her in his arms across this channel. So this young woman is somehow connected with the man from the dream. He says, do you care to meet her? Do you want to see her? And he says, I can't say, I don't know. And he says, he's here on a matter of business. I'm here on a matter of business. I have a business charge to acquit myself of. In your reception of it, don't heed me any more than if I were a speaking machine. Truly, I am not much else. I will, with your leave, relate to you, miss, the story of one of our customers. And she says, a story? And he seemed willfully to mistake the word she had repeated. He said, yes, it's a customer. Banking business. We usually call our connection to our customers. He was a French gentleman, a scientific gentleman, a man of great acquirements, a doctor. Now, before I go any further with this, we have to rest on this fact that he continues to state that it's a matter of business. Matter of business. It's merely business. I am a man of business. I have business to conduct on behalf of one of my customers. And that's all it is. He says, I am merely a machine. They address me as a machine and think of me as a machine. Now, Mr. Lorry, he is, of course, he's not just a machine. And we get our first glimpse that he's not just a machine, because when he sees Miss Manette, he doesn't see his matter of business that he's here to conduct and finish. And we'll talk about that in a second. But he sees the child that he held in his arms on a passage across the channel. And he lays out this story. He says, we had a customer, a French gentleman, a scientific gentleman, a man of great acquirements, a doctor. She says, not of Beauvais. Why, yes, of Beauvais. Like Monsieur Manette, your father, the gentleman, was of Beauvais. Like Monsieur Manette, your